Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris FX and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish. I'm a working film and TV editor. For the last 9 years, I've done over 400 interviews with the world's best editors. I've been using Boris FX products for almost 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today, on Art of the Cut, we speak with Lucy Donaldson, the editor of Kenneth Branagh's latest film, A Haunting in Venice. Lucy's feature film work includes Unspoken, Breaking News in Yuba County, Ma, Stuck, and Choice. Before I hop into our discussion with Lucy, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for Mac OS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free, no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris FX. I've been using Boris FX and Sapphire for almost 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris FX is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris FX suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. Lucy and I discuss a few scenes from the movie. If you want to see those scenes, be sure to check out that blog at borisfx.com/AOTC. And now, Lucy Donaldson on editing A Haunting in Venice. To start with, tell me a little bit about how you got involved in this project. How did you and Kenneth find each other? I saw that you worked on Cranford. Was that a possible...
No, it wasn't. Happened in the way that it never does, but people think it should do. It came to me via my agent. I didn't know anyone in the...
I thought he saw you at the lunch counter and he was like, you're the next editor.
Felt like it. My agent sent me an NDA and then told me who the director was, and my jaw was quite slack when I found that out, and obviously very excited. And, you know, I've always loved Ken's films, and of course Agatha Christie. I, like everybody else, grew up with the films and the books, and it was extremely exciting. So the first time I met him was on Zoom for the interview when we were talking about the script.
Did you read the book before you either had the interview or did the movie?
I purposefully didn't read the book or see any of the other productions until after I'd finished, because I knew there'd been quite a lot of detours from the book. And it was a very complicated script. And I didn't want just a piece of information in there that would muddy the waters. So, and normally I do all the preparation that I can, but that was a conscious decision. I think it was the right one, because there were a lot of pieces that I had to kind of keep together and make sure that I was very clear on it, especially for the interview. I wanted to be very confident in who the characters were and what the plot was before I could talk more about tone and approach and influences.
It's like a 50-50 split of editors between whether you do the research or you don't. And as you said, it might depend on the project.
I like to be as prepared as I possibly can, especially with a meeting like that. I feel very uncomfortable winging it. And the same with dailies. I'm really methodical about watching everything, unless it's impossible, unless we're under a time constraint, which makes it impossible. I feel uncomfortable without having seen everything and prepared everything. That's very much my personality. I like to write lists. I like to know what's coming up, what I've got to do. And it's certainly how I work. In my cutting room, I have one wall with my scene cards and another wall with my calendar. Because I feel if I've got the practicalities set, that frees me up to be creative. I don't work well in chaos. I can do it. Sometimes it's stimulating, but I don't like it.
You mentioned the scene cards. So did things structurally change much, or did those scene cards just help you keep on track?
I like to have scene cards. I find them, it sounds very nerdy. I like just to look at them. So I feel I can see the film in one. It didn't change as much as some films that I've worked on, but of course there were scenes that moved around and a few lifts, not many, but that's the way my brain works. So I always work with scene cards.
Did you find there was a lot of compression in the first act, as usually happens?
Yeah, there were a lot of scenes that were much longer, setting up the environment, setting up the characters. We've got a party in our first act that there was a lot of good material, and it was montage-y. So it was a lot longer initially, and then after we'd done the first preview, it reduced again, which is the usual way to have people say, no, it was slow at the beginning. So it's really that balance of making it nifty, getting the information that you need without it dragging or without it being convoluted or missing key information. And we did quite a lot of work on the Ariadne Oliver character because she's a fast talker, and there was a lot of dialogue in that scene where she's basically roping Poirot into her plan for him. And so we cut it right back, and then we ended up putting more in and having a couple of ADR lines so we can really be, this is who she is, this is what she wants from him, and have the salient points there. So yes, there definitely was a trimming of the first act.
It's almost like focusing a camera. You've gone too far one direction, you pull back and you go the other direction.
Right, yeah. And Ken was ruthless about lifting things, but he's very courageous in that way.
Did it seem like a lot of the compression was, how quickly can we get to the seance? Was that the big first thing that you needed to get to? Was it just getting into the palazzo?
It was getting into the palazzo and then getting to the murder. Certainly with Agatha Christie, there are a lot of expectations and a structure. Certainly getting to the palazzo, but we wanted to set Venice up as well, as a, it's Venice, but not as you know it. And also set up Poirot is in a different space than the previous Poirots. He's more somber, it's post-war, he has more self-doubt. He's not the showy, show-off Poirot that we'd met before. And so it was important to show that through his self-soothing daily routine. Poirot is not okay, basically. So we didn't want to rush that, because once we're in the palazzo, we're pretty much trapped in the palazzo. We do pop out for a few times for emphasis, but having the closed doors and it being a unity of time and space, I think is very effective. But we didn't want to sell ourselves short at the beginning either. So it really was a balancing act, and we did a lot of work on the first two reels to try to get that right.
Some of the compositions were very interesting, the camera compositions. Did that make it tricky to edit just because of eye lines and that kind of stuff, or did you just treat it like any other footage coverage?
There were some tricky moments with eye lines. Hopefully that doesn't show.
No. I'm just curious because the compositions are so, they're pretty radical. Like they would be on a show like Mr. Robot, I think, as, you know, somebody's composed very far off to one side of the screen, looking in a direction you don't expect them to look.
Yes. And there were lots of decisions made during pre-production about having the film make people feel slightly off, uncomfortable, slightly off kilter. There are very few camera moves. So one of the things we talked about at the beginning was the pacing and the rhythm would come through the cut. But there are some, like there's that big camera move when Poirot's walking through the main hall of the palazzo and the camera does a 360. And when I got those dailies, I was like, what do I do with this? But it was actually very simple. He had in his mind's eye how he wanted to come out of it, and it worked a treat. And it was an extraordinarily well-planned shoot. And I think because, you know, he was acting and directing, he really does a very thorough pre-production. So when he's on set, he's just with the character and with the other actors. So a lot of it came together really well. But of course, there are always instances where we cut out a line where someone's moving, or for whatever reason, there was a challenge. And there was a scene that I felt very pleased with myself because I'd flopped 4 or 5 shots, and to my eye, it was seamless. And I was like, no one is ever going to know. It was one of the actors' decision. They were after one line, they wanted to move forward to a different mark. And I think they were up against it with time. So for the second half of that scene, I didn't feel that the eye lines particularly worked. So I flopped a lot of shots, and then Wakana, the hair and makeup head of department, found that to be not ideal. So I had to unflop them all. I was like, rats. So yes, that didn't happen a lot, but they're the fun problems to solve.
Often between scenes and to show passages of time, there were very cool exteriors and interior details. Were those all in separate bins and you would go, oh, I need a cool detail shot, or I need an exterior? How was that organized, and how did you find those shots, think about them, keep them in your brain? Oh, that'll be good for this, whatever.
Yeah, it wasn't easy because there were quite a few options and different sorts of options. So I had a bin of atmospheres, and that was something that we talked about at the beginning. To build an atmosphere in the palazzo that suggested that this house is breathing, that this house is whispering, that there are things going on behind doors. Are they human or are they not human? And to really have that fun and interesting atmosphere. So we talked about having just shots of closed doors, which would suggest what's behind the door without answering it. So that sort of idea. And then there were the exteriors, but I really like the unusual shots. And the idea is, you know, this palazzo has been around a long time and many lives have been lived in it, and that it has its own personality. So, yeah, not the easiest thing to manage, I have to say. But I definitely did have a bin of favorites that I would pull from. And they're usually the things like, oh, we need to get some time out. And then they come out and then it's like, oh, but there's that real gem. Let's put that in over here. And also we had Harry, who's one of my favorite characters. He's the parrot cockatoo, who was also Harry's watchful eye. I enjoyed going to certain moments. And also we pulled moments from scenes that weren't necessarily intended for that. Going out to the exteriors of the palazzo, there was some shot of Pinewood. So the lowest story was built of Pinewood, the exterior. And then there was also a model shoot. And it was quite a big model. I don't know what the scale is, but they did a few days of exteriors of the model. And then there was the real building in Venice. So we were trying to make those three elements as seamless as possible. Ken wanted to use more classic filmmaking techniques for this film. And I think that fits in with the sort of style of the film that it was. So there were fewer visual effects than there might have been. And that was a conscious choice to do as much practically as possible.
The seance where she first uses that, she types on the typewriter. And I love the rhythm of that. It's kind of a jump scare, and it's got a wonderful rhythm of a couple quick cuts as she executes this first medium trick. Can you talk about crafting that?
It's one of my favorite scenes too. And the brief that I got from Ken was at the beginning to have it as jagged and uncomfortable as possible, and to be with the characters as if the audience was in the seance too. So they've all come in with their various dysfunctions. And at this point, they're getting a bit freaked out. So it was to have that jagged, jumpy feeling as if we were there. So the first time that I cut it, there was a great shot, which was handheld, unusually going around the participants. And Ken said, "Now I want to be in the table with the attendees." The typewriter was obviously a gift for sound and imagery as well. I got a really nice bin full of the most unusual typewriter angles ever committed to a digital camera, I imagine. So we had a lot of choices. And again, the idea was not to have a nice, easy rhythm, but to have unusual shot choices, unusual rhythms. So as if you're looking around a room and you don't know what you're meant to be looking at. And obviously Poirot is doing exactly that, and he's looking for evidence of why she's a sham. So yeah, that was a really fun scene to cut. And I was helped admirably by my associate editor, Alex Fenn, who did some really good work on it. And so it was at the beginning, we had this kind of odd, almost abstract feel for the setup and the beginning of the seance. Then there's the interruption in the middle by Poirot, and then the pace really takes off to a crescendo. So it was a lot of fun, but it was quite challenging in that there was a lot of coverage needed. And so I was really, well, we were really stealing glances and moments, particularly towards the end, to really keep the momentum going. But from the day that the dailies came in, it was one of my favorite scenes.
Is there anything that you do to prepare or to organize so that when you sit with a director for notes that you're able to deliver to them quickly options or help them revise what you've done?
Most of the time, I would pre-prepare an alt. If there was something, for example, if he'd asked to see something a certain way and I'd had another idea, I would present what he'd asked for first, and then I would suggest I did another alt if you want to see it. Most of the time we would talk about options, and then I would go away and do those options. The only time I did anything different was during what we called the denouement, where Poirot gathers all the characters and there are lots of flashbacks. So that was an organizational feat. In a scene like that, the first thing I do is cut it into sections for my own sanity. And they're usually about 3/4 of a page of the script. On that particularly, I had Poirot's side, I had everybody else's side, and then I had the flashbacks. I don't think I did anything special. If, you know, a director wants to sort of cut live, and of course I can do it and I will do it. I find it quite stressful though. But sometimes great things can come out of that when you're doing that live. You know, I did have some bins, like my favorite atmospheres and my favorite things, but usually I would say to them, let me prepare some options and I'll show you when they're done. And I think most people prefer that. The denouement was the only scene also that we used script sync on, because certainly on the Poirot side, there were lots and lots of angles and lots of different performances and reactions to those. So that was really the only time that I was able to say, let's look at all the deliveries of these lines. Let's look at all the reactions to these lines. And that was very helpful. I don't typically use script sync, but in that instance, it really was very helpful.
I've never done it for an entire film, but I've often done it for a specific scene that's very complex.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about pacing out some of the quieter moments that help build the tension, how long to be in those. Often they were around Poirot thinking or feeling or wandering around the palazzo.
Again, they started off much longer. I'm thinking particularly of the time where he's in the cape and the mask, and we're in the piano nobile, it was called, in the palazzo, the main room. And it's really the moment that he has started to be intrigued by this house. He started to engage with it, and he's having a bit of fun with it and listening. And it is really the sort of thing that could be as long as a piece of string. So I think originally I did a full revolution of it and him reacting as we go around the full 360. But I tend to cut, probably not unusually, a little bit looser to begin with. And then as we get towards picture lock, I did a real fine tune of cutting out frames between lines, or any time I felt once we had the pace, it was very clear when certain scenes that I'd cut earlier or scenes like that, they felt out of place. So it's generally quite a fast cut film, and I think it's important to have light and dark and slower moments as well as the more active scenes. But it was really just a balance and feeling it out. I don't think there's any other way to do it that I know of.
From the flip side of those quieter moments, there's a great scene where Tina Fey's character and Branagh's character have this very fast-paced discussion right after he talks to the son outside the bathroom. Can you talk about the reason for that pace, the need for that pace, and how that was cut?
It's after two quite long talkie interviews with Olga and with Ferrier. And then after the bathroom, it's another quietish scene with Leopold. So we did feel, looking at it as a whole, that it was time for some humor and some levity and, yes, yeah, some quick editing. And that was actually one of the scenes where I sat with Ken and we cut it together. It was quite unusual. The first version of the film that I cut, I put in all the comedy because there was a lot, and there was a lot of sparky interaction between the two of them. And then we reeled it back a little bit because we were trying to get the right balance between the somber tone and the humor. And then we put some more back in. So by the end of it, we were leaning into that as being one of the moments that we did need some levity. And then we go into another interrogation. So, yeah, well spotted. It was certainly something that we were conscious of. Oh, it was clear from the dailies that it was absolutely genuine. And there was a longer scene when Poirot asks Ariadne to help him investigate. And it was pretty flirty as well as funny. And you could really see that they were having fun in character. And they both have very big egos, the characters. She was doing a lot of, you'd ask me for my help. And, but he was saying to her, I'm giving you the respect to ask you to help me. Yeah, it was great. It was great. And I would have liked to have put all of that in. But again, it was getting the balance with the whole story. I think it fits in with Poirot's slightly dented opinion of himself. And he has more self-doubt that he would be with. And he's a bit shaky for various reasons, and that he's more open. Maybe we could even say teachable. Yeah, it made for a great dynamic. And Tina is wonderful at, you know, sort of just raising her eyebrow or sort of making sly asides, which were ad-libs. So yeah, that was really fun.
One of those moments that I really liked in the film was, I can't remember there's a scene where they're interrogating her and Poirot figures out that she has maybe been a nun in her past life, and when he says what does he say, or perhaps a convent, there's a great reaction shot to Tina Fey right there, like, how did you do that?
Yeah, oh, she was on fire that day. Honestly, there were so many, just the way that she can move her eyes, and it was just another way to pepper an interrogation, so I wasn't just ping-ponging between the two of them. She always had a good reaction to cut to. But that scene I particularly liked as well because of the incredible production design. There were glass doors or glass walls on both sides of that kitchen. One was a door and one was just a window through. And the way the glass distorted the image was very, I thought, beautiful and very much helped with building the atmosphere. So I was able to use that as much as I could do. But yeah, Tina always has a good look.
Tina was having good reactions, but somebody had to choose to cut to her at that moment.
Thank you.
You were talking about the glass doors and stuff. Was that also like there were sound effects? Like, talk about the use of the rain and the doors kind of shivering and blowing in the wind and other things that you used sonically to enhance that atmosphere that you were in.
Well, we had an amazing sound team. Simon Chase, James Mather, Thomas Blokus all did a really great job. And they were on early and they gave us some sounds that we could use really from the beginning. And again, the material just lent itself to that. One of the things that was interesting was Ken asked me not to cut with music for a very, very long time, seemingly, apart from a couple of spots. It was just like, hold off on the music, hold off on the music. So it really, we were able to sit with the cut as it was and that the sound design could really shine. I think there were only a couple of spots that we put temp music in and we used Hilda's score for those. And then we waited until Hilda had written her cues. So it really meant that the cut and the sound work could breathe. They just did a fantastic job. I mean, I think the rain obviously was very atmospheric, and for my taste, I would have had thunderclaps all over the place. But Ken was keen not to overdo those tropes. And hopefully we found the sweet spot of having some fun, but without overdoing it. But again, it all leads into this, the house has been there longer than the humans that are currently inhabiting it. The weather itself is subsuming the house, and the house is sinking, it's rotting, it's leaking, it's groaning. The electrics are dodgy, you know. You have the feeling that anything you touch, you might be the last thing you ever do. Just to give it that jagged, dangerous feeling of hum, of atmosphere, of the danger that they're cut off from the outside world and reason. And I think that was one of the things that I liked a lot about this film, is putting someone like Poirot, who's so driven by logic and is such a cynic, into an environment which challenges all of those things. And he's in a place where he's more vulnerable. And so if he'd been swashbuckling, overconfident Poirot, there wouldn't have been as much to play with. So I thought that was really interesting.
I'm assuming the interiors are shot at Pinewood. Were you nearby or even...
I was at Twickenham Studios, so not nearby on a Friday afternoon rush hour traffic. I did pop up there a couple of times, but mostly I was based at Twickenham. But I have to say, one of the most joyful things was the sound team were at Twickenham, the visual effects team were upstairs, Ken's office was on the other side of the building. And post-pandemic, it was such a joy to work with people in person. And I think it really helped how much we worked together. And I think it impacted what we made together as well, because it just meant you could run up a set of stairs and be like, what was that? And just talk about it like humans do.
I think so many people are happy to be in person with their director, for sure, even though there's advantages to the remote work. But there's definitely something that's missing.
Yes, I think those moments of spontaneity and just ideas that come out of conversations are really valuable. And I'm not a fan of remote working just because of the sort of person I am. Certainly in some situations, it's helpful, but there is a magic in collaborative working that happens in person.
Another one of the scenes that I wanted to talk about, it's actually two scenes, is there's the in that two separate interrogations of the medium's assistants, and they take place in two separate locations, but they're intercut. Were they scripted as intercut, or were they scripted as...
Yeah, they were scripted as intercut, yeah, and it was a really well-written scene. With each of the interrogations, we tried to do something different. And Poirot has split up the siblings on purpose to have them on the back foot. And then we tried to reflect that in the edit. And we also had a lot of beautiful wides on both sides of the interrogation. And so Ken said to me, why don't you use the wides, go to them whenever it feels right to disorientate the audience in the same way that Poirot is trying to disorientate the siblings. That was great fun. Starts off more rat-a-tat and then becomes more emotional. And one of the phrases that Ken used was secret sadness for each of these characters. We find out what their secret sadness is. And hopefully that gives the film a more emotional grounding, that a lot of these characters are sort of beaten up and survivors, and we find out who they are as humans rather than just two-dimensional characters who are passed by.
Can you remember any of the reasons why you might not have done the intercutting as scripted? Or what is in general a reason why you might not follow a script, the intercutting of the script exactly?
We didn't rearrange it majorly, but it was just things like a turn of phrase that we might split up. I think mainly what we did was cut between the two siblings more rapidly to emphasize their differing impressions of the situation. So Nicholas is very naive and Desdemona is very knowing and cynical.
I want to play for you another scene.
The first thing that I remember from cutting that was when we cut to the chandelier before it falls, but just to place it in the environment, because so much of that is in close-up. We wanted to mark it. There's a big chandelier with children playing. And there's also a really practical reason for that is they've walked around a corridor and they're in a different place. So we needed to go somewhere else anyway and to come back to them arriving in their second positions. But it was more... it was very helpful to have that chandelier brought into the consciousness of the audience, so the fall of it would have more impact. Poirot's mini speech about ghosts and gods, that was an area that we'd cut down further in the second or third go around, and then we ended up putting back. And I was pleased because I felt that it was worth giving him his moment of saying why he has no patience with ghosts and gods and spirits. You know, he's seen too much of the world. And I think that was important for him to say it, even though some people could have gleaned that from the time period that would fit in. But that was a moment that we put back in. And I think the writer, Michael Green, was very pleased by that.
Can you talk about that delicate walk that you need to do, or how you deal with a director who is also the lead actor?
Yes, it was something I was very conscious of and something that I was taught at film school, actually, emphatically, to talk about the characters by the characters' names, and particularly when one of the actors is sitting in your room. It reminds me of something funny during the denouement, the long scene where Poirot unravels all the misdeeds for everyone else. There was a lot of coverage on Poirot's side, different angles, different performances, and we'd use script sync, as I said before. We were talking about different lines and intercutting a line for two phrases, one from the other. And I said, oh, the one with the long pause. He said, the long pause, Lucy? I'm a Shakespearean actor. Do you mean the meaningful performance? And I think I said, yes, I'm very well aware of that. And we did have fun. But I'm very careful not to make any comment about the performance, or if I did, it was complimentary.
you cut Ma, correct?
Yes.
So that is a horror film, yeah. And this felt very, very horror-y compared to Murder on the Orient Express or yes. Death on the Nile.
Yes. I think it was particularly nice to be involved in this project because Ken was trying to do something different. So it wasn't just a jolly old murder. Let's solve the case in a nice, cozy way. But it had a very different striking tone. And I think that's why I was in consideration at the beginning, because I've had genre experience. I've worked at Blumhouse a lot. I cut Ma and The Midnight Club. And I'm very steeped in that genre filmmaking and also some horror comedy. So I did have some experience. And it's something that I enjoy very much of playing with tone. So particularly with horror comedy, it's when are we building atmosphere and tension, and when are we breaking it and relaxing and having some fun. So it's always a tightrope walk. And yeah, similarly in Ma, which was quite different, but that had, I think, more of a camp to it, which I enjoyed very much. But we did want it to be unnerving, at least, and intriguing, and to make the story work as a whole. So yeah, it's a tone I enjoy. I will say one more thing, which I found very interesting, is there's a house in Venice called Cadario, which has a history of each of the owners meeting an untimely death. And when they were in pre-production in Venice, locals were saying, no, but really don't shoot there. And they were sincerely concerned that there would be trouble if they filmed in Cadario, but it's in the film. It's shown in the gondola ride down the Grand Canal. But I really like that story, that Venice is a superstitious city and there are ghosts there.
Talk to me a little bit about building the tone of the movie that I thought was so beautifully set up in the opening credit sequence. Before you even meet Poirot or leading up to seeing him for the very first time.
Yeah, thank you. That's one of my favorites as well. And I'm sure it doesn't surprise you to learn that it was much longer to begin with. So yes, after the Pinewood shoot, they all went off to Venice for a week and we didn't know what the weather was going to be like. And it was the morning that they did those establishing slot shots was that sort of slate gray sky. And so it lent itself towards the fog that we added in visual effects, and I was just very drawn to the shots that had a graphic look about them, and so looking at St. Mark's Square in a very different way. But the incident that happens with the birds was just a gift. I mean, there was quite a lot of that material, and I was watching it all, and I was like, oh my god.
I thought for sure that was a special effect. Are you kidding me?
It was absolutely real. Yeah.
That's horrifying.
The filmmakers may have thrown a few almonds on the ground. May have done that. But that was as much manipulation as there was. Yeah. So I was like, well, that's going in. We ended up building that whole sequence around that. We started off, we had some material from outside the city and it being a sort of journey into St. Mark's Square. But in the end, we just decided to have sort of strong, bold compositions.
Yeah, the compositions are very angular. And I've been to St. Mark's Square and I never looked at it that way.
Right. So that was really what we were trying to do, is to say this is Venice, but not as you've seen it before.
Lucy, thank you so much for talking to me about this film. It was so nice to talk to you, and congratulations.
Thank you. Great to talk to you. It's a real honor to be invited on the podcast. Thank you so much, Steve.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. And you can see the scenes we discussed on the podcast. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Lucy Donaldson for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hullfish. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut content every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.